Blog Talk Radio. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Wild Horse and Burro Radio, an educational outreach program of Wild Horse Freedom Federation. You're welcome to call during the second half hour of the show with any questions you might have for our guest, or if you'd like to comment on any of the issues we'll be talking about. Our guest today is Eric Molvar. He's the executive director of Western Watersheds Project. And we were lucky enough to have Eric on our show a couple years ago, and so we're really happy to have him back on again. The goal of Western Watersheds Project is to protect and restore Western watersheds and wildlife through education, public policy initiatives, and legal advocacy. Western Watershed Project works to influence and improve public lands management throughout the West, with a primary focus on the negative impacts of livestock grazing on 250 million acres of Western public lands. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thanks very much, Debbie. I'm delighted to be here.
Good. Well, can you tell us what's one of the most important issues that you're working on right now?
Well, one of the most important issues we're working on right now is trying to keep public lands in public hands and prevent them from being turned over to local governments and exploitive industries. And interestingly enough, the Bureau of Land Management has been holding secret meetings with local county governments and individuals that represent kind of industrial exploitation in order to change the way that the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, manages the public land, specifically their National Environmental Policy Act policies, so in other words, how they do their environmental reviews, and also their planning regulations, and the idea that they're pursuing in these secret meetings. And Western Watersheds Project was able to quietly sit in on one of these phone conferences thanks to a person of conscience in one of the agencies that leaked us the call-in information. And what was transpiring was basically that the BLM and these local county governments were working together to try to make county governments more responsible for managing Western public lands that belong to the federal government and that are supposed to be managed for the public benefit for multiple uses, not just for local benefit and for the single use of exploitive industries.
Yeah, well, and, you know, it's alarming that these are secret meetings behind closed doors and the public knows nothing about it. And I can guarantee you, if we filed a FOIA for these records, you know, a Freedom of Information Act request, not only would it take a year to get them, they'd be heavily redacted because they would say, oh, it's deliberative process or whatever. So it's very hard to get actual records of this. So it's good to know there are people with a conscience out there that care about our public lands.
Well, indeed, in Western Watersheds Project did, in fact, put in a Freedom of Information Act request to get those recordings because we know they're recorded, and they have yet to be produced.
How long ago did you file the FOIA? Do you know?
Back in early October, right after the last meetings took place.
Yeah, well, good luck. We'll be following up on that, and as soon as you post anything, we'll be sure to get the word out there. This is a really important issue, not only just for our public lands, but you know, for our government, the way it's run, you know, that so much is happening behind closed doors that the, you know, public should be invited to public meetings that are discussed how they're going to do this. So
well,
we're not part
of
the process.
And you know, the American public, every last one of the American public is a landowner of the Western public lands. And, in fact, a person who's a taxpayer who lives in Rhode Island has every bit the same ownership rights as someone who lives in rural Utah in terms of how mm-hmm. those Western public lands are managed. They're supposed to be being managed for the public interest. They're supposed to be being managed for multiple uses, including things like wildlife and watersheds and wilderness and some of these other values, public recreation, that have a real bearing on public use of the public lands. But it seems like the new administration in Washington is increasingly trying to turn back the clock to the days when the BLM was lampooned as the Bureau of Livestock and Mining.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I've listened to some of those meetings, like, you know, there's the Experimental Stewardship Committee. And you know, a lot of the local people treat public lands as their own private property. That's their attitude. And they kind of bully the BLM, it seems to me, into doing whatever they want. That's just my take.
There's
on
a lot
that.
Of truth to that. And I think, you know, when you talk to Western ranchers, it's really not considered very polite to ask them how many acres that they have in their ranch. But if they ever tell you, they're not just counting the acres that they own, the acres that they have title to. They say, they're going to say, I have a 50,000 acre ranch, and they're counting into that 50,000 acres National Forest or Bureau of Land Management federal public lands that they don't mm-hmm. own, but they're merely leasing the livestock grazing on into their ranch, and they act like they own the place, and they throw their weight around kind of with that in mind.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And just for some of our newer listeners, livestock grazers can even get bank loans based on their allotment, leasing, you know, livestock grazing allotments, which that's like getting a loan based on renting an apartment. You know, that's a big issue that always needs to be addressed, I think. Eric, can you tell us, I know also lately, tell us about that ag gag case in Wyoming. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it all started a number of years ago. Our Wyoming director, Jonathan Ratner, for many years has been gathering water quality data on public lands and going out and gathering water samples and testing those water samples and also sending those water samples into the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality for testing to see if those waters are in compliance with the Clean Water Act. And what we've been finding is that for many of the areas that have heavy livestock grazing, the levels of E. coli contamination in these public waterways are far, far beyond the water safety standards under the Clean Water Act. And so the ranching community was, of course, angry because it was their cattle that were causing the contamination. I mean, domestic cattle tend to concentrate along and in the stream courses, and they tend to urinate and defecate right into the water. And the result mm-hmm. is they're using Western public lands as an open sewer, and your water quality levels reflect that. And so there's a radical pro-ranching attorney by the name of Karen Budd Fallon, who's based out of Cheyenne, who's always looking for ways to try and undermine environmental conservation. And she gathered together a series of plaintiffs and pitched them on the idea of trying to trap Western Watersheds Project into being prosecuted for trespassing. And they brought this case to assert that WWP had been trespassing based on the fact that Jonathan Ratner had driven out to Western public lands that are free and open to the public on a BLM road that is numbered and marked as a public roadway. And they tried mm-hmm. to catch us on the technicality that parts of that public road crossed private land and that the easement had not been granted to the BLM to make that public easement open to the public. But nobody knows this. And so, mm-hmm. consequently, you could go and do a title search in the local county assessor's office and do a title search on the road. And if you looked it up, you could figure out, if you knew how to do the research, you could figure out which parcels of land were crossed by the road and whether there was a public easement across that land. But there's no way of knowing on the ground, because in Wyoming, a lot of these private lands aren't marked. And so their allegation was that WWP must have trespassed. They were unable to prove that. And in fact, the judge handed down a ruling that basically said, there's no way that I'm going to hand out down a penalty to Western Watersheds Project in this case. You guys need to get together and settle this one out. And so Western Watersheds and Bud Fallon's rancher plaintiffs reached a settlement agreement in which they produced a map that showed explicitly where all of the different public easements were and were not. And WWP agreed, of course, not to trespass, because that's our policy. Mm-hmm. We never trespass intentionally on any of these public lands, and we do everything in our power to try and find out what the legal public access ways are and to use those at all times. So in the end, Bud Fallon lost her case and got nothing. We got a map to show where the areas that were the roadways that were open and which ones were going to be problematic, and that's where that ended up. And having failed to win their trespass case against Western Watersheds Project, the ranchers then went to the Wyoming legislature and said, we want a law now that makes this kind of data gathering on public lands illegal if you inadvertently cross private land on the way to public land. And it's important to note that every different state has different trespass laws. And in Wyoming, the trespass laws are really, really favorable to the landowner and unfavorable to the public. So if you are a private landowner, you have a right of reasonable access to your private land. But if you're a member of the public and you own public land, you don't have the right to have reasonable access across private ground in order to get to that public land. So an easement has to be gotten. And so what the legislature ended up doing was they ended up putting out a data trespass statute that said, if you cross private lands either knowingly or unknowingly to get to public lands and then gather data, even something as simple as taking a photograph and then submit it to a federal agency, there is going to be an additional penalty of more than $1,000, and there is the possibility of jail time for this additional data gathering trespass over and above any kind of civil or criminal penalties that you could be assessed under the actual trespassing statute that has existed for many, many years.
And just so our listeners know, the Wyoming legislature is full of ranching interest. You know, it's like a part-time job to them. Or you know, it seems like a lot of them are ranchers who are also, you know, serving on that board, on that committee.
Well, certainly that's true. In Wyoming, the legislature is government by the ranchers for the ranchers, and it has been set up that way deliberately. The legislature is completely unpaid other than just having a per diem. And who can afford to take 1 to 2 months off in the middle of the winter and not work? Well, ranchers, because they've got nothing other to do in January and February. So they get to do it. Everybody else has a real hardship serving in the legislature. And as a consequence, what you get in the legislature in Wyoming is mostly ranchers.
Are you going to be able to challenge this data trespass statute, or where do you go from here with that?
Well, in fact, Western Watersheds did challenge the data trespass suit, arguing that the statute interfered with our constitutional right to free speech, because when you go out to the public lands and you're gathering that data and you're giving that data to the federal government, that is a form of speech, and they are trying to suppress that science and suppress that speech that says these waterways are contaminated, these federal environmental laws are being broken, the federal government has to do something about it. And so we took that to the Wyoming District Court. The judge ruled against us, perhaps unsurprisingly, and we appealed that up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals told the Wyoming District Court, you were wrong, that gathering is indeed a constitutional right, and that constitutional right by this data trespass statute has been violated, and you cannot discriminate against people who are gathering data on public lands and submitting data to federal agencies on the basis of trespassing, because you already have a statute. Either somebody trespasses or they don't. And if they haven't trespassed, you can't go after them for collecting data. And if they have trespassed, you should be using your existing trespassing statute.
Good. That's good to know. Yeah, Jonathan Ratner recently wrote that article, and I love this title. It's kind of funny. Swimming in a cow toilet, majority of Wyoming's waters lose protections from fecal bacteria. So that had to do with the EPA and a reclassification and downgrade of water quality. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Or to secondary water, contract waters?
The Wyoming state government reclassified 80% of the streams in Wyoming down to secondary contact waters, which means that they're no longer primary contact waters or waters where people are expected to recreate. And that's factually inaccurate because anywhere there's water in Wyoming, anywhere there's a free-flowing stream, there's going to be somebody going there to fish. There are going to be kids that go down to the stream and play in it and wade in it. And what this functionally does is it allows more than five times more E. coli bacteria than would be allowed in a primary contact stream, which was how they were all classified prior to this reclassification. And sadly, the Environmental Protection Agency has approved the state of Wyoming's reclassification. And what this means is that today, if you are coming to Wyoming as a tourist or if you live there as a resident, you ought to be very, very careful about fishing in the rivers and streams and allowing your kids to play in the water, because it may have levels of E. coli contamination that are fundamentally unsafe for people that are just splashing around in the water. And this E. coli bacteria, of course, is found in manure. It's found in human feces as well. And if you ingest it, you can get very sick. You can have very serious stomach problems, and people have even died from it. So this is a really serious environmental problem that we have here in Wyoming, thanks to the Wyoming state government relaxing those water quality standards.
Yeah, I read an article, and although E. coli is a national problem, it's especially severe in livestock areas. And this is a great fact. A single cow can shed as many as 1 billion fecal bacteria per day. That's 1 billion with a B. And another thing that's concerning to me with Pruitt and the EPA is they want to cut the research and science staff by 50%. So it was already bad enough, and now they're going to make it worse, as far as
science.
Well,
in the West,
they
say, don't drink downstream of the herd. And that's never been truer than it is today.
Yeah. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the misrepresentation of industry interests that, like, claim to speak for Westerners?
Well, certainly. In the West, there's a whole good old boy network. And it includes groups like the Farm Bureau, the Stock Growers Associations, the local county governments, and the National Association of Counties. It includes groups like industry interests. And they all work together to try and create a false narrative that Westerners really want maximum exploitation of public lands. They really want to have maximum industrial use, maximum logging, maximum grazing, maximum mining, regardless of the environmental consequences. And as a corollary to this, these right-wing pro-industry forces want to create the impression that Westerners don't have an environmental conservation ethic and, in fact, don't like conservation standards, things like the Endangered Species Act, things like the Clean Water Act, that actually protect our public lands and guarantee access for the public. But instead that all Westerners basically want to allow the pillaging of our Western public lands to line the pockets of economic interest. And this is absolutely false. The conservation ethic for the actual people that live in the West runs quite deep. And it's a widely held view that Westerners really want to have wildlife conservation. They want to have better recreational opportunities. They want to have better hunting and fishing opportunities. They want to go and enjoy the wide open spaces free from lands that are degraded by industrial interests or overgrazing by livestock industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And do you think kind of too, along with this, that the livestock industry in, pushing, that they speak for the Westerners, they kind of make it seem like their economic importance is greater than it actually is? Like, is the
absolutely true. The livestock industry is an economic pipsqueak, and it's kind of a joke. I was just driving down the interstate in Albany County, Wyoming, where I live. And there's a billboard up, and it's a few years old, but it brags that the livestock industry brings in $3 million a year to the Albany County economy. Well, the Albany County economy is a hundreds of millions of dollars economy, and the livestock industry has this tiny little sliver of the pie. And yet they're crowing about that as if they're some of the local economy and the local jobs base. When you go to, you can go to Headwaters Economics, which is an independent economics consulting firm, and they have what's called an economic profiling system, where you can call up any county in the West and find out what proportion of the jobs and what proportion of the dollar value of the economy goes to agriculture. And in every Western county, even the ones that have the tiniest amounts of towns and cities, you're going to find that the amount of the economy and the amount of jobs is typically 5% or less of the total economy. It's just not a reality that the livestock industry is even economically relevant. But the folks that are in the ranching industry and their lobbying groups are bent on kind of perpetuating this myth that the livestock industry has some importance to Western economies, when in fact it's the service industry. It's people who are in high tech, who are in the tourism industry and other industries that are actually driving local economies.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere that the Wyoming state economy, ranching was only 1.8 of the employment, but they have political dominance. So here you've got like a very minor interest group having huge or almost all of the political power. So that's interesting. So what's happening with sage grouse? Is there a myth being perpetuated about sage grouse?
Well, there absolutely is. And we've all heard this phrase, nobody wants to see the sage grouse listed under the Endangered Species Act. And I remember having a conversation with a Colorado senator's office staffer a couple of years ago, talking about Gunnison sage grouse, and this staffer was telling me that, oh, nobody really wants to see the sage grouse listed. And I told this staffer, you know what, these anti-conservation forces that are selling you this bill of goods about nobody wanting protections under the Endangered Species Act are full of it. You can look at the Colorado College surveys that are out there that show that in every Western state, even in Wyoming, the majority of voters are just fine with protecting the sage grouse under the Endangered Species Act. But he didn't believe me. And then just last year, I ran across a 2004 study of voters in Western Colorado that was done just on the issue of Gunnison sage grouse. And they found that in Western Colorado, which is considered to be very conservative and a bulwark of the ranching industry, they found that the majority of voters in Western Colorado wanted the Gunnison sage grouse to be listed under the Endangered Species Act. And that's exactly the opposite of what the local county governments are telling everyone and what the state government and Governor Hickenlooper is telling everyone. And both of those two entities are actually suing to get the Gunnison sage grouse delisted and the protections removed, even though in the most conservative part of Colorado, the Western Slope, the majority of voters support Endangered Species Act listing.
Well, and for our newer listeners, many ranchers, we're not bashing all ranchers. A lot of ranchers own their own land. Many people, I think, try and be good stewards of the land. But, there's many ranchers that are mostly big corporate interests, like mining companies that buy ranches to get the water rights. And they're not the cowboys they make out to be. So Eric, how do you think the federal agencies are fooling the public about their protection of sage grouse?
Well, certainly there's an awful lot of smoke and mirrors going on about sage grouse protection. And under the Obama administration, when the sage grouse plans were completed, they had a lot of built-in loopholes to them that actually undermined sage grouse protection, even in the areas where the protection levels were supposed to be highest, the priority habitats, conservation areas. And so, for example, the BLM's own experts told the agency they need to stop leasing the sage-grouse priority habitats for oil and gas development. And in fact, in the final analysis, what they adopted, the agencies put forward a plan that actually allows oil and gas leasing throughout these priority habitat management areas under what are called no surface occupancy provisions, which is supposed to mean you can't put an oil and gas drilling rig or a road on these areas. But in reality, also provided what are called the opportunity for exceptions, modifications for those lease stipulations, so that you can get out of those restrictions if it's inconvenient. And so it was sort of a sham protection for oil and gas.
So they built in loopholes.
They did. Yeah. And for ranching, it was a little bit different. In ranching, for most states, they had a provision that provided an objective that said you have to maintain 7 inches of grass height in these priority habitat management areas. But one of the secret loopholes that they were counting on was that there was in 2014 a law called the Grazing Rider, which was an amendment to the Federal Lands Planning and Management Act that basically allows existing grazing leases to be renewed after they expire under their previous existing terms if the BLM doesn't have the personnel or the money to do a full NEPA review. And guess what?
Somewhere
between 73% and 85% of the grazing allotments in each state, including areas that are priority habitats for sage-grouse, are being renewed under this loophole without incorporating the new sage-grouse protections.
And it's a 10-year permit, too, right? They're just reissuing 10-year permits. So
that's right.
They're not protecting the sage-grouse at all. Huh. Anyhow. What about sage-grouse habitats that fall outside specially designated areas?
Are there
any habitats outside?
There are about a little over half of the sage-grouse habitat is outside of these priority habitat areas, and it's in what's called general habitat or important habitat or sometimes other habitat management areas. And these areas have basically token protections. They don't even have the flimsy promise of sage-grouse protections that then gets pulled out from under the sage-grouse like a rug when it comes down to making these public land use decisions. And another thing that I think is a really important factor that is really degrading sage-grouse habitat all over the West is cheatgrass. And the federal agencies like to talk about cheatgrass and wildfire as being a main threat to sage-grouse without talking about the fact that it's livestock grazing that causes the cheatgrass problem in the first place. Cheatgrass is an invasive species. It's an invader. It comes in degraded areas, and it kind of takes over when you suppress the native perennial bunch grasses that are supposed to be there. And, of course, the livestock don't like to eat cheatgrass any more than the wildlife do because it has these little seed heads called cheats that get into their mouths and cause them to have sores and make it painful to eat. And so, consequently, the livestock avoid eating the cheatgrass. The wildlife avoid eating cheatgrass, and the more cows that you pile into a public lands grazing allotment, the more they mow down the native perennial bunch grasses, which can effectively compete with cheatgrass and exclude it if you don't have the heavy livestock grazing.
And someone gave me an interesting thought. You know, cattle have, their hooves are cloven, they're pointed, so they're like perfect little shovels to dig down in the, in the soil, so that's what really helps spread it, it seems.
That and also the fact that the livestock in particular are very hard on the biological soil crusts. So in the Great Basin states of Nevada and Utah, parts of Idaho, where you have biological soil crusts that are really important for maintaining water in the soil and fixing nitrogen into the soil for plant nutrients, when you come in with the livestock, you tear up these biological soil crusts, you bust the crust. That opens the door for the cheatgrass invasion. Without that heavy trampling, the biological soil crust itself is a buffer against cheatgrass and inhibits cheatgrass germination.
Well, earlier we were talking about livestock contaminating water. They also contaminate soil, don't they? So if E. coli goes in the water, I'm assuming it also gets on the soil.
Well, certainly these E. coli bacteria are being spread everywhere you have a cow pie. And so, you know, that can be a source of contamination even if you're not drinking the water.
We're about halfway through. We're halfway through the show now, so I want to remind our listeners, if you'd like to call in and ask Eric a question or comment about any of the issues we're discussing, you can call in area code 917-4520, then press 1. Eric, we kind of touched on this earlier. What about claims that there's a lack of support for the Endangered Species Act? What are the statistics on that? Do you know?
Well, Defenders of Wildlife did a poll in 2016, and they found that close to 90% of American voters are strongly in support of the Endangered Species Act and protecting species on the brink of extinction. And the idea that we should just go ahead and allow species to go extinct for the sake of producing more dollars for corporations is just not an American value. People feel very strongly that we have a responsibility as the species that has the heaviest impact on the natural environment to make sure that our activities and our uses of the land don't cause these species to go extinct. Because once you lose them, they're gone forever. You can't replace them then at that point. And one of the things that I can tell you as a professional ecologist is that we don't know everything about how these different native species interact with each other and which ones are important for the survival of others. And so there are unintended consequences. When you lose one species, it may have major impacts on a suite of other species. If you pull one strand of the fabric, the whole skein unravels.
Or even certain animals and certain plants, you know, everything's interconnected. I think we have a couple of callers calling in with questions for you, Eric. Marty, do we have?
Yes, from area code 530. And this is our, I'm sorry about that. This is our new host on Tuesday nights. Carly Walden is calling in to speak with you. Go ahead, Carly.
Oh, hi, Carly.
Hello.
Hi, Carly. Hello?
Maybe not. All right. We'll
we
try number
Carly.
Two.
Okay.
Yeah, we did. Okay. Area code 303. You're live and on the air.
Hi, Eric. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Go right ahead.
Great. Well, this is Charlotte Rowe from the Wild Equid League of Colorado, and we love everything you do and the way you get it out there to the public. My question has to do with what you just raised about the interaction between different species. But I'm going to go political first. What do you think it would take to eventually get ecologists, because there have to be others like yourself and conservationists, to be able to make common cause with the wild horses and burros? And the need to preserve them on the range, because, you know, as far as I can see, as long as they're blamed for everything that happens to the ecological balance, we're not going to be able to do anything about livestock grazing. And the other thing is that that affects the sage grouse directly, as you know. You know, there are some even BLM officials who have admitted that wild horses do in circumstances eat the cheatgrass before it goes to seed. We just don't know enough about that. But the other thing is the fight to keep the public lands. And in many cases, again, the wild horses and burros are in the way of those who want more of the public lands for extraction industries and livestock and everything else. And, you know, they stand against that theft. But it's a real long haul to get any kind of common cause going. So I just wanted to ask that question.
Well,
yeah, what
are
your thoughts on that? Yeah.
It is a long-standing issue, I think. And, you know, I think there are a lot of misconceptions about wild horses in the West that are really actively fanned and actively promoted by the livestock industry. And the livestock industry likes to scapegoat wild horses and blame wild horses for rangeland health problems that are typically caused by the livestock industry itself. And it's a convenient way to just to point the finger at somebody else, so you don't have to take responsibility for the overgrazing that your domestic livestock are causing. And the fact of the matter is that based on my read of the information, there are about maybe 21 to 23,000 wild horses in the West. The BLM likes to claim that there are 72,000 wild horses in the West, but I think those numbers are inflated and very suspect.
Everybody agrees that
there are 3 million cattle in the West. And so the cattle on public lands are outnumbering the wild horses by 36 to 1. And they're
and
really
–
it
could be even double that because, as you know, the Bureau of Land Management counts a cow-calf pair as only one animal. So it could be 6 million. So, you know.
Well, that's right. And they count a mare and a foal as two. Yes, absolutely. And so the bottom line is that livestock so outnumber wild horses that especially when you're looking at areas that have both wild horses and livestock, it's almost always the domestic livestock that are causing the real impacts. And it's extremely rare for wild horses to get so numerous that they're actually having a significant environmental impact that you can weigh in on. And I spent 3 years of my career as an environmentalist working on sage grouse, so that's an issue I know very well. And there was a journal article that was written in 2011 about the impacts of wild horses on sage grouse. Interestingly, that same volume that was supposed to be tackling all the different impacts that were hurting sage grouse populations didn't have a chapter on livestock. I find that very curious. But this wild horse chapter pointed out that only 12% of sage grouse habitats have any wild horses at all. That means almost 90% of sage grouse habitats have no wild horses. So wild horses cannot be having any impact at all on sage grouse on those lands because they're not there. And basically the livestock industry is trying to do is to try and create this illusion that wild horses are a major cause of rangeland health problems so that everybody will ignore the elephant in the room, that it's the livestock industry that's causing these widespread range problems, and it's everywhere in sage grouse habitat. I think, you know, one of the things that I think is an artifact of how things rolled out and how things historically were presented in the public was that there was a very big controversy in the 1970s over wild burros in certain areas that were perhaps overpopulated but were certainly competing with desert bighorn sheep. And at that time, desert bighorn sheep were very rare, and there was a lot of conservation focus on that. And so that narrative kind of set the tone for how the scientific community and the research community and some in the conservation community started to think about wild horses and burros, because in the Wild Horses and Burros Act, they're lumped together, even though they're very different species. And so I think that, you know, little seed in the very beginning kind of created a pretty wide-scale perception and a misperception in the conservation community and the scientific community that wild horses were only a problem. And I think that's perpetuated itself today, and certainly the livestock industry is taking full advantage by trying to spread and perpetuate this myth.
And you know, what's really interesting, Eric, the Bureau of Land Management, their environmental assessments, you know, when they want to round up a bunch of wild horses, are very kind of elusive, because they'll say the number of wild horses, like, you know, 80 to 100, but they won't say how many cattle or livestock. They'll just say, do it in AUM. So nobody can actually figure it out till you go to their rangeland administration system and look it up. And then you're shocked at how many there are. And another favorite thing is they say, oh, well, the cattle only graze part of the year. The horse is there all the time. But, you know, there's certain months where maybe 6 months of the year or 10 months of the year, yeah, they might not be there too much 2 months of the year, but for 6 or 10 months, they're there in very great numbers. So, you know, they cherry pick what they want to say, and it's not the whole truth.
Oh, that's very true. I recall that there was an incident where there was a sage grouse population in Oregon in eastern Oregon that was doing very poorly, and it hit its triggers because the population dropped below the benchmark that was supposed to trigger increased conservation action. So the BLM did a report and a write-up on the causes of this problem. And the BLM went through the different possible causes, and one of the causes they listed was wild horses, and they devoted several pages to wild horses and the possible impacts that they might be having on this sage-grouse population. Well, it turns out that there was only 5% of the sage-grouse population that even had any overlap with wild horses in this particular case. Meanwhile, 100% of the sage-grouse population was overlapping livestock. But in their report, they said, oh, livestock grazing, that's not having any influence at all on sage-grouse, even though the same kinds of impacts that they were purporting to be a problem and attributing to wild horses are the kinds of impacts that livestock grazing causes themselves.
Well, I wanted to thank Charlotte for calling in with that question. Thanks, Charlotte. Can you tell us a little bit about the Koch brothers and their lobbying groups?
Well, the Koch brothers are the probably the single wealthiest right-wing political donors, and they have created a whole suite of what are called AstroTurf groups. And AstroTurf is when you're trying to fake grassroots support, and you're trying to, you know, so you set up an institute, and you kick out a bunch of studies, and you put out a bunch of press releases, and you're trying to create the illusion that your particular views are widely held. And so the Koch brothers are involved in funding the Public Lands Council and some of the other really extreme anti-public lands groups that are working with folks like Ken Ivory with the Utah legislature on the most radical federal land sell-off plans. And basically their goal is to take the western public lands that belong to every American and get the federal government either to sell them to the highest bidder or deed them over to the states, knowing that the states will manage them to maximize industrial extraction and exploitive uses. And they are behind a pretty serious movement. And when you look at the Malheur Refuge takeover by the Bundy militants and the Bunkerville incident, you know, these folks are just the tip of an iceberg that is backed by tens of millions of dollars of lobbying money that's being spent to set up these shadow organizations that are trying to create the idea that Westerners want to get rid of public lands, turn them over to private landowners, put up the private property signs, and fence everybody out.
And, you know, to me, one of the things that makes America great is all of our great public lands. I mean, you know, Yosemite, I mean, all these parks. And while we're on this subject, can you tell our listeners a little bit about that secret report that was leaked from Secretary of Interior Ryan Zinke to the White House? It had to do with boundary reductions for the national monuments and prioritizing livestock grazing.
Bears ears.
And the other national monuments.
And this was a recommendation that was made by Secretary Zinke on the Bears Ears National Monument, Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, and 10 other national monuments that are large national monuments that the industrial interests would like to shrink, reduce, or get rid of entirely. And basically, in the spring, the Interior Department started this, what they called a review process, to review the national monuments that had been designated under President Obama and President Clinton, and even some that were designated under the second President Bush, to see if they wanted to make changes or boundary changes or changes to their management. And some of the recommendations in this report were that six of the national monuments were recommended for major reductions to shrink. And that's not legal for one president to take a monument that was designated under a previous president and shrink the boundaries. You don't get to do that. The actual authority to establish these national monuments belongs, is vested by the Constitution in Congress, and Congress conveyed that through the Antiquities Act, which was passed by Congress, that said that the president could create monuments, but it didn't say the president could destroy monuments. And so the idea that President Trump is going to go now and try and take the Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante national monuments and reduce them by 2 million acres and make those tiny little fragments of their former selves is completely illegal, and Western Watersheds Project and other conservation organizations and the tribes are suing to overturn that, and we're very confident that we're going to win that case, that we're going to restore these national monuments. But the other really sneaky thing that is in these recommendations is that Secretary Zinke made a recommendation that traditional uses, quote-unquote traditional uses, which he defined as grazing, mining, logging, and oil and gas drilling, should be prioritized in national monuments. And that is an offense to the Antiquities Act, to the conservation legacy of Teddy Roosevelt, who signed that act into law. And the entire idea of national monuments and the National Park Service is to protect and preserve these things, these treasures, for the benefit of future generations. And the idea that you should be managing these for the kinds of exploitation that destroy the historical and cultural artifacts and the geological features for which these monuments were designated is absolutely absurd.
Yeah. Meanwhile, well, one thing I wanted to get, since we got on the topic of, you know, Zinke wants to open these up to oil and gas, there's a lot of lobbyists that are very deceptive. So they'll form the same thing. They'll form, like the Koch brothers, they'll form these groups, and there's a deception and behind a lot of these oil and gas interests, I think especially in Colorado. Wasn't Anadarko Petroleum and Noble Energy behind some ads where they formed some group, Coloradans for Responsible Energy?
That's right. You know, the Coloradans for Responsible Energy Development was this AstroTurf front group that was created by Noble Energy and Anadarko Petroleum to try and fake the idea that Coloradans want more oil and gas drilling and less environmental protection. And this is particularly funny because in Colorado, there is no single group of people who is more mocked, who is more hated, who is more reviled than Texans. And the reason is that Texans come to Colorado every winter to ski, and they go on the Black Diamond slopes, and they, you know, get in the way and make fools of themselves, and they're very loud, and they don't go along with the whole Western idea of you know, not boasting and bragging. And so culturally, it's Coloradans aren't very fond of Texans. And here are two big oil corporations based in Houston, Texas, that come up to Colorado and run up the flag as Coloradans for responsible energy development and start putting out press releases saying how safe and wonderful oil and gas development and drilling is, and how people don't need to worry about fracking, how people don't need to worry about safety issues like the explosion that killed an entire family in Firestone, Colorado last year, and try and create the misimpression that local government should not be trying to regulate the oil and gas industry and should not be trying to put restrictions that keep oil and gas drilling rigs a quarter mile away from people's homes and out of residential subdivisions and off of school playgrounds and places like that.
Isn't it true that there's still no regulations requiring oil and gas to disclose the location or condition of their pipelines, even in residential areas there in Colorado?
I believe that is true, and not only is that true, but I believe that there are probably thousands upon thousands of miles of buried pipelines that go to abandoned and plugged oil and gas wells that belong to companies that went bankrupt 10, 20, 50 years ago that nobody knows where these pipelines are anymore, because those pipeline alignments were not reported to the state. There was nobody that was responsible for keeping track of where they were located. And so when the real estate
developers came along
on these old oil and gas fields, and they didn't even maybe know that there were old oil and gas fields underfoot. and they started building these residential subdivisions out in rural Colorado. In many cases, they were building houses right on top of old natural gas pipelines, and as it turns out, tragically, some of those natural gas pipelines have enough natural gas to blow up a home.
Tell our listeners a little bit about the Onshore Act, if you can, as long as we're talking about oil and gas.
Well, the Onshore Act is a bill that is designed to take the federal government out of the position of managing and being responsible for the development of federal land and federal minerals, oil and gas development. And so it would turn over to the states the ability to auction off federal lands for oil and gas leasing, and it would turn over to the states the authority to approve oil and gas drilling projects. Now, remember that currently, even though the federal oil and gas system and their oversight is really poor, really weak, the environmental safeguards are really full of holes, the states are even in a worse position. The federal government
they even have less money.
The federal government has a National Environmental Policy Act that requires them to go and do an environmental assessment that, you know, to have a look before you leap approach, to look at different alternatives, to take a hard look at the environmental consequences of oil and gas development. And even if they're not doing a very good job, states like Wyoming don't have any regulation at all requiring any public input, requiring any hard look at the environmental consequences, any look at alternatives. And so turning over oil and gas development on federal lands and putting states in charge of federal public lands in terms of their mineral development would be an absolute disaster, especially given the fact that the states have a vested interest in maximizing mineral production and minimizing environmental protection because they're on the take. They get,
they get part of the profits,
the oil
from
and gas
it.
Royalties, or the coal royalties, of the of those types of mineral royalties. And so what you see throughout the West, throughout history, is that the state governments almost universally lobby for more, drill, mine, and so they can maximize the income to their legislatures because it's a tax that they don't have to pay a political price for.
Now, in 2014, many acres of public lands were pulled from oil and gas leasing auctions. Do you think the federal agencies are going to put these lands up for auction again?
Well, that's the difficulty. And frankly, all throughout the Obama administration, you know, the Obama administration put together federal sage-grouse plans covering 70 million acres of public land that were really weak and full of loopholes and did a very poor job. But what they did do that was good is they stopped leasing those sage-grouse priority habitats. Whenever there would be leases proposed by the oil industry inside these priority habitats, they would defer them and pull them out of the lease auction and not lease them. And that was the real thing that the Obama administration was doing right, because if you don't lease the priority habitats and there's never any oil and gas drilling in the future, then it doesn't matter how weak your oil and gas standards are because there's no drilling in the first place. And when the Trump administration took office now, all those acres that were kicked out, and there were more than 3 million acres of priority sage-grouse habitats that were offered for that were nominated for lease by the oil industry but were kicked out of these lease auctions, these all can now come back. And the new administration gets another shot to issue these 10-year leases to explore and develop federal public lands and to pump out the oil and gas resources that belong to you and me, the American taxpayers, for their own private profits.
Well, one question, and this is kind of just a personal interest to me, is the killing of all these the wildlife and birds. You know, we talked about the lack of support. You know, they're trying to make claims that there's a lack of support for the endangered species. But what do you think of all this killing of, you know, wildlife, birds, you know, that, you know, Wildlife Services is doing?
Well, certainly, you know, Wildlife Services is a rogue agency, and a lot of the members of the American public don't even know that the USDA has an agency that's dedicated solely to killing and discouraging native wildlife for the benefit of farmers and ranchers. And this is an agency that in 2016, where they have the most recent statistics, killed more than 70,000 coyotes. They killed more than 21,000 beavers. Now, beavers are a keystone species for our native stream systems. They're critically important, not just for the health of the streams and the health of the fishes, but also they are key to the health of the water tables in these fertile lowland areas. You wipe out the beavers, you end up desertifying the air, the surrounding meadows. And they're wiping them out. And why? Because the livestock industry wants them gone and finds them inconvenient. And, you know, the difficulty here is that we have a livestock industry that basically, as a basic philosophical tenet, wants to wipe out any species, native or not, that interferes with their bottom line in any way, shape, or form. So that means species that compete
wild
with
horses.
Cattle for grass. It means that species that might take an occasional calf or an occasional lamb. And it involves species that just get in their way, like beavers, and occasionally build dams in the culverts and flood their roads.
Well, I think when the American public thinks about the political bullying this one industry is doing over all of our public lands and wildlife, it's really, I'm hoping it's coming more to the forefront for mainstream media to pick up on. But, you know, certainly this is why, you know, Western Watersheds Project and many other environmental groups, the work they're doing now is so, so important. Eric, this is a question. Why is it so important to keep public lands in public hands?
Well, you know, as flawed as the federal government is, and as bad and as pro-industry and as crass as its choices sometimes are, if you turn these lands over to the states, or worse yet, to private interests, you're going to get unfettered commercial exploitation of these lands, and we're going to lose them forever. And it's important to know that our Western public lands are the fundamental basis of who we are as Westerners. And indeed, worldwide, this is what America is famous for. If you go over to Europe and you say you're from the United States, they're thinking of these wide open spaces, these national parks, these spectacular lands that are gone in Europe. They don't have them anymore. So they come all the way to the Western United States as tourists to experience the idea of these wide open spaces. And that is really the priceless birthright of all Americans. And the thing that is really most valuable that we have about the Western public lands, it's not the board feet of timber you can produce, or the amount of oil you can suck out of the ground, or the amount of grass that you can turn into sides of beef and send to the supermarket. It is the land itself that is our priceless legacy. And if we turn these Western public lands over to the states or to private interests, we're going to have lands that are degraded, denuded, and destroyed.
Yeah. So your children won't be able to enjoy the camping, the fishing, just enjoying nature, you know, going out and seeing this beautiful land like they do. I was really shocked when, I did a cross-country road trip, and when we got to Wyoming, seeing all the oil and gas, I in my mind that Wyoming was going to be just, you know, gorgeous, and I was pretty shocked by all the oil and gas.
Well, a lot of and a lot of these places in Wyoming used to be beautiful even only a decade ago, and they've been transformed into industrialized landscapes. And this is really killing the goose that laid the golden egg by destroying our Western public lands, because it's the quality of life that is the cornerstone of the new Western economy. It's why you have lone eagles wanting to bring their businesses to the West. It's why you want to have high-tech companies that want to locate to places like Boulder and Salt Lake. It's because of the recreational opportunities and the public lands and the quality of life. That's what's really fueling the Western economy as it moves into the future. And if we lose our Western public lands, we're going to be no different than Illinois or New Jersey or some of these other places that have already gone over to 100% privatization and have lost
that
legacy. Thanks,
Eric. We're on our last few seconds here. I want to thank you for being on the program and encourage everyone to go check out the website for Western Watersheds Project. And thanks so much. And, Eric, it's been a great show.
Well, thanks, Debbie. It's been delightful to be here, and thanks for having me on.
Okay, and thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you the next, or we'll be on again. Talk soon. Bye.